I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering an online master's degree in healthcare administration. Learn the skills necessary to be a leader and make an impact in the ever-evolving and diverse field of healthcare in partnership with UW Extension. Details available at uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have a conversation today that could not be more timely. A conversation with Dr. Richard Gunderman, who is Chancellor's Professor of Radiology, Pediatrics, Medical Education, Philosophy, Liberal Arts, and Medical Humanities and Health Studies at Indiana University, a prolific author of both articles and books, and most recently the author of a book called Contagion: Plagues, Pandemics, and Cures from the Black Death to COVID-19 and Beyond. This book gives us a fascinating look behind the long history of humankind's contention with a wide array of various maladies, and really helps us understand the place of infectious agents like viruses and bacteria in our lives and in our world, and chronicles for us the long battle that has ensued, which at one point Dr. Gunderman characterizes as a dance of disease and death. This fascinating book is published by Welbeck. And Dr. Richard Gunderman, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I want to ask you, first of all, about writing a book that takes such a long view of this topic, given the fact that someone with your credentials might have chosen to write a book much more closely focused on the current scourge, COVID-19. I mean, very specifically, you have chosen not to do that. You obviously feel that a longer view is helpful and maybe to some extent missing from our conversations about COVID-19. Tell us more about that.
I think you're absolutely right about that. I sometimes worry that the word unprecedented is overused, and that, you know, while we've never had a pandemic, COVID-19, the SARS-CoV-2 virus that causes it, we've in fact confronted situations like this at many points in the past. It reminds me of a saying of a great American philosopher, George Santayana, that those who don't learn the lessons of history are doomed to repeat it. And as you point out, human beings have been wrestling with epidemic and pandemic disease not only as far back as history extends, but we even have evidence of such diseases prior to recorded history. And I think to understand what's happening today, we really need to situate it in that kind of broader historical context.
Another point which is made in your really interesting book, Contagion, is that these infectious agents that we think of almost entirely in negative terms should not be thought of in simply negative terms, that at least in some instances, such infectious agents actually play an important role, perhaps even an indispensable role, in life itself. Explain what you're saying there.
Well, that's absolutely true. We think each adult human body has somewhere between 50 and 75 trillion cells. Boy, is that ever a big number. It would be the number 75 followed by 12 zeros. By comparison, the number of hairs on our head would only be about 100,000. So, we are not just human cells. We're made up of, bacteria, fungi, viruses. At least we carry them around with us all the time. And I think you're absolutely right. When most of us hear the word bacterial, chills run up and down our spines. And, we tend to think of, say, antibacterial hand soaps as a good thing. But in point of fact, human well-being really depends on many of those microorganisms for a number of reasons. I bet some listeners know that vitamin K, it's one of the vitamins that's essential for blood clotting. Vitamin K is actually synthesized, made by a bacteria in the human intestine. And, vitamin K has been synthesized that way and enable our blood to clot, presumably as long as there have been human beings. So in some cases, bacteria actually help to keep us alive. We wouldn't be able to make bread or beer, let's say, without fungi. I mean, the yeast we associate with the production of those things. And then another reason that bacteria are important is because the relatively benign or harmless bacteria that can be found on our skin or in our mouth and our intestines and so forth, if they are not there, if we wipe away those relatively benign bacteria, we sort of clear the ground for bad actors to move in. And that's sometimes what happens to people who are placed on antibiotics. The antibiotics which are used to treat, pneumonia or strep throat or what have you, sometimes they can kill some of the good bacteria in the intestine, and then the patient ends up with an infection by bad bacteria like Clostridium difficile, often called C. difficile, and that can be a very difficult infection to eradicate. And in one of the greatest ironies I can think of over the course of my medical career, one way to treat those infections today turns out to be basically taking fecal material from healthy patients and putting it in the intestines of patients with this particular infection. So instead of killing the bacteria directly, you sort of crowd it out, take up all the real estate with good bacteria again, and the bad bacteria don't have space to work their mischief.
Hmm. Your book chronicles many success stories when it comes to things like smallpox and cholera and tuberculosis, among others. And in some respects, we might jump to the conclusion that as our scientific understanding and know-how and resources have grown so dramatically, that surely we would be able to kind of wipe all of these threats away completely, which, of course, has not occurred. These threats are not by any means totally eradicated, and new threats continue to emerge. And you point out that that has a lot to do with the way in which so many human beings live, having changed so dramatically over the last few years in ways that promote the transmission of infectious disease. Highlight a couple of the most important ways in which the way we are living is, in a sense, heightening our susceptibility to some of this.
Oh, that's a great question. One example would be transportation. Hundreds of years ago had the virus that causes COVID-19 jump to a human being, in Wuhan province, China, or some other part of the world. Human beings didn't travel even within countries, let alone between countries or continents or to the other side of the world nearly as often, and certainly not nearly as quickly. So it would have been much more difficult, I think probably impossible, for an infection like that to spread worldwide. But of course today, with intercontinental jet travel, a virus could spread from one side of the globe to the other in just 24 hours. So that increased mobility of human beings is one way we've made it a lot easier for pandemics to spread. Another example of that in recent history, I bet many listeners know the great influenza pandemic of 1918, perhaps the worst the world has ever known. I mean, there are estimates that as many as 500 million people, 500 million people were infected, and perhaps 50 million or more deaths. In that case, a clear promoter of the spread was World War One and its aftermath. You know, you had troops going from other parts of the world to Europe to fight in World War One, and then returning afterwards. And that movement of otherwise healthy young adults probably did a lot to spread the infection around the world. So transportation and mobility are one big factor. I think another big factor is probably the encroachment of human beings on the natural habitats of species that might harbor these viruses, you know, coronaviruses, for example, of which SARS-CoV-2 is an example. They may be found in birds and bats. As we human beings encroach more and more on the natural habitats of those species, the probability of one of those viruses jumping from, you know, a bat, let's say, to a human being goes up. So to some degree, we may need a better ecological understanding of how infectious disease operates if we're going to successfully prevent such pandemics in the future.
We're speaking with Dr. Richard Gunderman about his newest book called Contagion, Plagues, Pandemics, and Cures from the Black Death to COVID-19 and Beyond. You explain to us, and I'm so glad you do, in the third chapter of the book called The Life of an Infectious Microbe, the way in which bacteria and viruses do what they do, and you describe a chain of six links. It must gain entry, it must establish itself somewhere, it must avoid the defenses of the human body, it must reproduce, it must produce toxins, and it must survive. And if that chain is allowed to, in a sense, function uninterrupted, then that's when terrible things occur. And you say that scientists and physicians are seeking to disrupt or break that chain at various points. So, for instance, when we're talking about something like COVID-19 and developing vaccines, what point in that chain is disruption occurring when we vaccinate against a given disease? Where in that chain is the disruption occurring?
Yeah, well, one thing is to train the human immune system to attack the virus. So very soon after the virus shows up, the immune system is aware of, let's say, what that virus looks like, so to speak, what some of its key proteins are that the immune system could detect. And then because of that prior exposure, it's able to mount a relatively fast response to it. So before, you know, the patient certainly gets very sick, like would need to be admitted to the intensive care unit or at least the hospital. And we hope in most or all cases, before the patient even develops any symptoms, the immune system, because it's been previously primed to attack such a protein, you know, one of the proteins on the virus, it can basically take the virus out before it makes us sick.
Hmm. You described that one of those sort of six stages is that of producing toxins. And you also tell us that for a pathogen to do this in the right way, in a sense, it needs to not create too much damage too quickly or it destroys its own home. It destroys the host. So it must be toxins produced at, in a sense, the optimum level. Why are those toxins created in the first place? I mean, do they serve any particular function for the pathogen itself, or are those toxins created in a sense specifically as weapons to attack?
That's a great question, and I would say with respect to cholera, which has, you know, been a scourge of humanity for decades, centuries, millennia, many listeners will know that cholera causes, among other things, terrible watery diarrhea, and that's caused by a toxin that the cholera organism produces. Well, nobody knows for sure why that happens, but it seems like the best explanation would be if you could induce severe diarrhea in a host, you might stand a chance of contaminating, you know, the host, the people living with the host, maybe the neighborhood around the host, and that would be a very efficient way for the infection to spread from one sick person to multiple sick people. But as you say, there's also a kind of counterbalancing concern, which would be that if the organism kills too many people too quickly, it may be impossible for it to infect anyone else. So even microbes, infectious microbes, you know, if they're going to survive and reproduce long term, probably don't want to be too lethal. I'm not saying they have desires in this regard, but, you know, it's not to their advantage to kill people too quickly or they won't be able to spread.
Hmm. Your long historic view of this topic takes us all the way back to the plague of Athens in 430 BC, to the famous Black Death of the bubonic plague in the early mid 14th century, and beyond to other pandemics and epidemics as well. And along the way, you introduce us to various figures who have played important roles in humankind's warfare against these various threats. One name that was only vaguely familiar to me and whose story I did not really know at all was Dr. Benjamin Rush, who was a signer of the Declaration of Independence. And I remember him for the role he played in getting John Adams and Thomas Jefferson to reconcile towards the end of their lives. But you tell us an amazing story about the role he played during the yellow fever outbreak of 1793 that decimated Philadelphia at a time when it was still our nation's capital. Tell our listeners why you want us to know this amazing story about Dr. Benjamin Rush.
Well, as you point out, Rush was a remarkable person. He was orphaned at a fairly young age. His mother had a large family to support. He was distinguished by his intellect from a very early age. And in fact, I think still remains today the youngest graduate in the history of Princeton University. But as you say, he trained in medicine, both in the United States and Europe, came back, set up a medical practice. Among other things, he wrote the first chemistry textbook ever authored on this continent. But he was practicing medicine in Philadelphia when a yellow fever epidemic broke out. Of course, back then, people didn't realize it was, you know, caused by microorganisms, that mosquitoes were involved in its transmission. They just knew a lot of people in Philadelphia were getting sick. And many people of means, including many of my predecessors in the profession of medicine, when they realized they were in midst of an epidemic, got out of town. You know, if you weren't in Philadelphia, presumably you'd be protected from that epidemic. But Rush, against that point of view, remained in Philadelphia and kept providing care to patients. Now, some of the care he provided doesn't make much sense to us today. For example, Rush was a staunch believer in the use of bleeding, phlebotomy, in the treatment of diseases. By the way, we still use phlebotomy to treat some diseases, but not nearly to the extent Rush did. But what I think is most remarkable and admirable about him was his refusal to leave town and abandon his patients. He did get his family to safety, but he insisted on remaining in Philadelphia to provide care. And in that sense, I think he's, you know, an exemplary physician in U.S. history. And I just point out there's actually a college, a medical college in Chicago, Rush Medical College, named after him. So the Rush name is well memorialized.
Very good. And I appreciate that your book tells us stories of people like him, and some names we will know to some extent, like Edward Jenner and Joseph Lister and Florence Nightingale, but other important figures not so well known to us. And as I said, you talk about various epidemics and pandemics, and in particular with the Spanish flu, as it is sometimes known, the flu of 1918, you disavow us of a number of different myths and misunderstandings we have about that particular pandemic. I want to spend our last couple of minutes talking about COVID-19. First of all, although we certainly see promising signs, and we are all grateful for that, of course, it has been a tough road for the whole planet, and in some ways, particularly for the United States. When it comes to our own nation's handling of the current pandemic, what do you think we have done well, and what would be some of the mistakes that one way or another have been made?
Well, I think, you know, there were a number of stumbles along the way. One was the initial suggestion that mask wearing wasn't necessary. There was no need for people to wear masks. I mean, that view was even spread through the television news program 60 Minutes. We soon realized that was bad advice. I think it was partly intended to help preserve supplies of PPE, personal protective equipment, you know, for doctors and nurses in hospitals. But the advice not to wear masks, I don't think was very good advice. On the other hand, we're in the midst of an unprecedented scientific and medical triumph, namely going from having sequenced the genes of the virus, say 14 or 15 months ago, to now not only having a vaccine, but delivering it to millions of people every day in the United States, and tens of millions of people around the world. Never before, to my knowledge, has a microbe been studied so thoroughly to the point where it was possible to produce a vaccine against it, and then have that vaccine made so widely available in so many different places in such a short period of time. So it's, I think, a real triumph of biomedical science, and something we should all be very proud of.
We are hearing, of course, about variants. In fact, just here in the county where we are located, the British variant of COVID-19 has been detected for the very first time. And, of course, there are other variants, including the South African variant, that are generating headlines and plenty of concern. Help us understand the level of concern that we should have about these variants and our ability to contend with them.
Well, the downside of some of these variants, like the so-called UK variant, is that it appears pretty likely it's more lethal than the earlier identified variants of the SARS-CoV-2. So that's bad news. On the other hand, it does look as though there's at least some cross-reactivity, that prior COVID infection, vaccine that we're distributing now might provide at least partial protection, certainly against the more serious manifestations of infection with that variant. So, you know, it's a mixed bag. On the one hand, we're detecting new variants, and it's quite possible that new variants will be identified in the future. But on the other hand, it seems at least right now that the measures we've taken, people who've been infected and should have some immunity, and also people who've received the vaccines will have at least some protection from that.
Explain why, even as more and more of us become vaccinated, that it is still important to engage in some of the preventative practices that have been part of this pandemic, such as physical distancing and the wearing of masks and so on. I think some people believe that with a vaccination, suddenly those things shouldn't be necessary anymore, or not to the same extent.
Well, you know, the medical profession is by nature a cautious one, and the concern is that even though we've been vaccinated, we may still be able to transmit the virus. And, you know, that could be trouble for somebody who hasn't yet had the infection or been vaccinated against it. Now, with each passing month, we will understand this more deeply and be able to provide more customized or tailored advice based on what we're learning. But for now, I think physicians and public health experts are inclined to err on the side of caution and encourage us to keep social distancing and wearing masks.
A last question. In the last chapter of your book, the chapter is titled The Road Forward. You mentioned the fact that we're living in a shrinking world in which we are all connected in so many different ways. You see a need for us to see ourselves as neighbors and collaborators. Explain why this is, in a sense, your parting words in this book.
Yeah, I think just, there are more human beings on the earth than there ever have been. We're often more concentrated than we ever have been in large cities, and we're also traveling more widely and more quickly than ever before. So in a sense, each of us bears a greater measure of responsibility for the health of everyone else. And I think if we can begin to see ourselves as you say, as neighbors, that can go a long way toward preparing us for the next pandemic and also enabling us to extricate ourselves from this one a bit more quickly.
Hmm. Your book is such an interesting examination of what you liken at one point to an arms race between human beings and various microbes that cause such damage and such trouble. Your book, again, is titled Contagion, Plagues, Pandemics, and Cures from the Black Death to COVID-19 and Beyond, published by Welbeck, the author, Dr. Richard Gunderman. Dr. Gunderman, thank you so much for giving the world this fascinating book, and thank you for being part of the morning show today. I'm glad I got to talk with you. Best wishes.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two of today's program features an interview that was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2002. Philip Gerard will be a familiar name to many of you, particularly to those of you that listen to us in the afternoon, to NPR's All Things Considered. He contributes frequently to that program. He has done a number of documentaries for PBS, is the author of a number of different books, most recently a book that is really extraordinary, which takes us into a chapter of the Second World War that will be completely unknown to basically all of us. The book is called Secret Soldiers: How a Troop of American Artists, Designers, and Sonic Wizards Won World War II's Battle of Deception Against the Germans. And Philip Gerard joins us for a few minutes on the morning show to talk about his book, Secret Soldiers, published by Plume Book. Philip Gerard, we welcome you to the program.
My great pleasure to be here. Thank you.
In a nutshell, tell us what Secret Soldiers is about.
Secret Soldiers tells the story of about 1,100 very special guys, artists and designers and actors and so forth, who were recruited and combined into a unit unlike any the U.S. Army had before or since. Their mission was a very simple one: to deceive the Germans about when and where American and Allied armies would attack between D-Day and the final crossing of the Rhine River that led to the downfall of Germany. And they had a number of ways of doing this, but basically they were creating one big magic trick on the battlefield. These guys could make whole armies disappear. They could create phantom armored divisions, basically conjured out of radio traffic, what they called rubber duckies, which were blow-up neoprene dummies that resembled tanks and artillery pieces, actors who would infiltrate into places where collaborators were known to be and pretend to be, releasing information that they shouldn't, and sound effects. They had a thing they called sonic deception, which basically meant they could broadcast high-fidelity sound for up to 15 miles across the battlefield and create the impression of just about anything they wanted in the minds of those people listening across the river in the dark or behind a screen of trees.
One of the things that you mention is the fact that this was done under an amazingly complete cloak of secrecy, and that the vast majority of U.S. soldiers, for instance, had no idea that these special troops existed or that they were even doing this work.
Right. This secrecy lasted well into the 1980s, and there were lots of good reasons for it. One reason is that deception most often is used out of weakness, and had we had all the armored divisions and all the infantry divisions that we needed throughout the Second World War, there would have been no reason to conjure them out of thin air. So you really don't want those guys in, you know, the 28th Infantry sleeping next to you to know that instead of the armored division, which they think is covering their left, in fact, you've got five half tracks and a bunch of loudspeakers and a bunch of kind of nerdy guys that came out of the University of Chicago or somewhere playing sound effects into the dark when there's a real, very real Panzer division sitting across the river licking its chops waiting for you, you know.
Yeah, I suppose the whole enterprise loses its effectiveness completely if it isn't done in secret.
Right, although toward the end of the war they began to get very clever, and at one point during the Battle of the Bulge when they needed to get some relief to Bastogne, for instance, the planners in the 23rd Headquarters Special Troops, which is what the official name for these guys was, decided that they would try something really interesting. And what they decided to do was to take two divisions, the 4th Armored Division and the 80th Infantry Division, and divide them up and just simply make two of them. One of them was real, and one of them, of course, was fake, conjured solely out of radio traffic. They knew the Germans would know that one of them was fake, but they were counting on the fact that they had a 50% chance that the Germans would guess wrong, and in fact they did. The Germans followed the radio traffic instead of the real units. The real units ended up linking up with the beleaguered troops in Bastogne, and it's one of the untold stories of how that siege was actually lifted.
Of course, almost every bit of this story is an untold story in a sense.
Right.
And that's one of the things I want to ask you about before we probe into a few details. I like how, I think in the introduction you said that after all of this work of deception, which this special unit did, their last disappearing act was to vanish from history.
Right.
And indeed, as you say, all of this was cloaked in almost complete secrecy into, I think you said, the 1980s.
Well into the 80s, yeah.
First of all, when did that cloak eventually become lifted, and was it in any sort of conscious way? I mean, what did someone finally make a sort of an official decision that now we may begin to talk about this in a more open fashion, or was their work more sort of discovered?
I think the declassification proceeded, as many times it does, by inches. That is, by the time it was declassified, pretty much anybody who knew anything about it in detail was long gone, of the people who had planned it, I mean, officers and people in the War Department. And so through very routine kinds of audits of what's in the archives, things began getting declassified as people began to ask for them. The first written account of this that I'm aware of that went into any detail was a magazine article that was illustrated by Arthur Shilstone in 1985 for Smithsonian. Shilstone, who worked for Smithsonian, was a very gifted artist, and he had been one of the members of this unit.
Mm.
And that was really the first and only, you know, peep out of this thing. So once I got to the archives, I realized there was a whole raft of paperwork that was now being declassified and was available, and also lots of stuff missing, lots of things that turned up only in the footlockers that some of these guys had brought home from the war, or in their diaries, letters, you know, other kinds of things that they had saved, which allowed me to piece together the story. And, of course, their wonderful interviews. They were very forthcoming in helping me to fill in the gaps.
I suppose that's one thing we should be really grateful for, is that you came along interested in this story at a time when, many of the principal participants, as you already said, are already gone, and the day will come when none of these men are alive anymore. And
certainly,
so,
well, one of my best informants was Colonel Clifford Simonson, who is, you know, at the ripe old age of 93, still going strong. And, he was one of those guys I found through an internet search, you know, cold calling people till I found a guy that would tell me about a guy who would tell me about a guy. And then I finally got to him, and this was, you know, late August and of 2000, and he said, geez, you know, come out to Colorado and see me and we'll talk. And he goes, better yet, we're having a reunion in 2 weeks. Why don't you meet us up there? And so I, you know, got on a plane to Watertown, New York, and met, you know, 30-some of these guys, and they were just remarkable.
Mm.
And it is true, they're older gentlemen now. The youngest at that point was 74, the oldest was Simonson, and most were in their 80s. Bill Blass, unfortunately, has already passed away since I've talked to him. He was one of the key members of the group as well.
Mm.
One of the things I appreciated about the book was that, you know, as we read this and we think to ourselves initially maybe, boy, this is incredible and unprecedented. I've never heard of anything like this. But time and time again through the book, we are reminded that the art of deception has been a part of warfare almost from the beginning. Give us some sense of that.
I think the first time that anybody attacked anybody else in the Stone Age, there were probably the next time they tried to attack, the person who had been attacked the first time tried some ruse in order to fool them and gain an advantage. Because that's really what it's all about. There are two great advantages to deception in warfare. One of them is that if you're weaker and you're either attacking or being attacked by a stronger force, it gives you an edge. And that was proved time and again in this war as in others. The other thing is that, and there's a very humane sense in which it does this, it helps you to limit casualties. That is, if you can attack a stronghold without having to go head-on with the enemy and slaughter people on both sides, but in some other way cleverly get them to surrender or cleverly get behind them, do some ruse and attack them in such a way that there's very few casualties, you actually can fight a much more humane kind of war. So one way of looking at this is that these guys did a mission that was quite altruistic from a lot of points of view. It was altruistic in the sense that they were putting themselves on the line, literally making living decoys out of themselves, saying, here, come get us, while they pretended to be something they were not, which was, 10,000 strong with tanks and guns. And on the other hand, what they were doing philosophically was trying to end the war with a lot less bloodshed, and I think they succeeded marvelously in both.
That's right. You give us actually two main purposes behind this, one of them being to minimize casualties. The other is really the essential thing here is the idea of turning weakness into strength,
right,
and of putting the underdog into a better position than they might otherwise be. And it's important maybe for us to remember that at least at certain points in the Second World War, in certain situations, that's exactly what we were.
Well, for a very long time, we have to remember that we didn't have an Allied victory until October of 1942, when Montgomery and Al Alamein in North Africa finally was able to defeat Rommel on the battlefield. And he did this through a magic trick. In fact, he had a magician named Jasper Meskelen working for him. And what they basically did was create a fake army on the southern flank by the use of decoys, by the use of radio traffic. They had created dummy soldiers, dummy railroad lines, and so forth. And then they actually, under cover of darkness and under cover of other kinds of camouflage, took an entire army and moved it to the northern flank, which is where they jumped off from, with great success. And Churchill recognized this in the House of Commons. It was a kind of turning point in modern warfare deception.
Incredible.
And it was the kind of the touchstone upon which all else was modeled.
It's interesting to me, actually, if we want to go back much earlier than that, I had not heard the story or don't remember hearing the story that dates back from our own war between the states, and actually something which the Confederates did in trying to bluff Union General George McClellan,
right,
using something that I think you called Quaker guns.
Quaker guns.
Tell the story. This is great.
Deception works best when it's aimed at the decision maker on the enemy side. That is, you want to target that person that can actually change the outcome of the battle, and you want him to do something you want him to do rather than what's good for him. In this case, the Confederates knew that McClellan was a very timid general. He was very good on the parade ground, but they weren't sure, in combat that he would stand up. And so what they did as he invaded Virginia and was on the road to Richmond was the Confederates cut down logs, painted them black, and stuck them in embrasures all along the roadway so that McClellan would wake up in the morning and his scouts would report cannons everywhere. And they weren't cannons, they were logs. But they understood their general, and they targeted that decision maker absolutely right on the money. And he saw those guns, pulled back, and said, I can't attack without massive reinforcements. And, of course, lost the initiative, and thereby Richmond held out until virtually the end of the war.
One more point which you make in the introduction, which I really think bears a bit of discussion. You say at one point, not all soldiers are fond of practicing deception. And you say that for many military personnel, this really runs entirely contrary to their basic instincts. And you go so far even to say that traditionally for American officers, secret soldiering of this kind carried a whiff of dishonor.
Yes.
Explain that a little further and how that, if it was, could be overcome.
Well, Cliff Simonson pointed this out to me. He was a West Point man, straight up and down, and he was given the task with this new unit of planning and showing them how to do what they were going to do. And he had no more clue about how to do this than I did as I started the book. And all he knew about soldiering was that the honorable thing to do is you charge at the enemy. You lead men in open battle, and that's the honorable thing. What he was being told to do was to lie not just to the enemy, but to his own superiors, to his own men on, you know, on his own side, to do things that seemed like they were skulking and in some ways cowardly. You know, that this was not the war of the cavalry soldier riding into the glorious battle, the glorious charge. And there was a huge problem undoing that mindset among the West Point officers, many of whom were picked to command this unit. And what eventually happened was that Simonson, as he began the arduous work of trying to turn this unit into an operational reality, actually came to appreciate the subtleties of it. I mean, he was a man who was a quick study. He was open to new ideas in a way that many soldiers of his era perhaps were not. And what he began to do was to become creative. And after a while, he became the most ardent disciple for this kind of warfare, partly because it could save so many lives. And so like many converts, he became the most rabid supporter of this particular brand of warfare. And the other thing to remember is that the Geneva Convention says a lot about deception. And there's a fine line between what's called deception and what's called treachery. Deception is acceptable. You can pretend to have Quaker guns, as they did in the Confederate Army. You cannot surrender and, under a flag of truce, then suddenly pull out guns and begin shooting at your enemy after you've disarmed him. You know, you can't do those kinds. So there's a fine line, and there's lots of room for ethical sliding.
This is a monthly test of the Southeast and South Central Wisconsin Emergency Alert System. In the event of an emergency, this system would bring you important information. This test is now concluded.
Forbidden by the Geneva Convention, you can't put troops, for example, in an ambulance painted with a Red Cross. You know, you're not allowed to dress your people in the uniform of your enemy, which both the Germans did in World War II and reportedly Saddam Hussein's Republican Guards did in the recent war.
So this is an utterly different kind of deception.
Right. And, you know, the other thing that should be said about the reluctance of those West Point officers was that there was very little chance for glory in this kind of a battle. I mean, if you're leading the 28th Infantry and you go through a bloody battle, at the end of it you all stand up, you pin your medals on, your picture's in the paper, and you get promoted. These guys, from the rank of captain on up, were in a dead zone for promotion. Nobody was ever going to know what they did. They couldn't leave the unit because they knew too much. They couldn't be promoted in the unit because there wasn't room for that many senior officers. And they weren't going to get the medals that they might have gotten. They weren't going to get the career boost they might have gotten. You know, Simonson should have probably been a 2- or 3-star general by the end of the war. As it was, he ended up as a colonel. So, you know, it was not the kind of way to make your reputation for the quick-rising, ambitious soldier from West Point.
For those of you just joining us, we're speaking today on The Morning Show with Philip Girard, who is the author of a fascinating book entitled Secret Soldiers, How a Troop of American Artists, Designers, and Sonic Wizards Won World War II's Battles of Deception Against the Germans. One of the things that your title implies is that the Germans maybe had their own aspirations for such deception. Is that... Am I misreading your title, or were they in this game as well to some extent?
Well, sometimes you're in a battle and you don't know it. And I think sometimes the Germans were suspicious of being deceived, and yet again and again they made wrong decisions. The Germans actually had begun the war using massive deceptions. The way they went into Poland was based on a ruse, for example. They staged a mock attack on a radio station. They went into Russia in a surprise attack. They went into Norway dressed as tourists. But because they got very bold and very full of themselves, in fact, German doctrine all the way, almost until the end of the war, stated that any German attack would succeed for a specified amount of time, and that varied from a couple of days to a couple of weeks, because they were so confident in the overwhelming weight of their armor. In a sense, they lost the flexibility that they could have gotten through deception. On the one occasion that they did use it, they really mimicked what the Americans had done, and that was during the Battle of the Bulge. They hid two entire armies right under the noses of the Americans, and through radio traffic and camouflage and other kinds of diversionary movements, they convinced everybody from Eisenhower on down that they no longer had the ability or the materiel or the men to wage war. They convinced them they had no more airplanes. And then suddenly, just before Christmas in 1944, waves of Luftwaffe bombers are coming out of the skies. You know, two entire armies are swooping down through Belgium and Luxembourg. And these guys, by the way, were caught right in the middle of it. Mm. And were scrambling around in many ways, becoming real combat troops for the first time, other times scrambling to get their top-secret equipment out of the way of the advancing Germans, and then participated, as we've talked about, in the relief of Bastogne.
We learn a lot in the pages of this book, and one of the things I really appreciate is that we learn about things that we sort of thought we already knew about. For instance, the art of camouflage. And you go to considerable lengths to explain really the principles of camouflage and sort of the difference between, you know, doing it brilliantly well and doing it not so well. And it seems as though that's one chapter of this story, is how the art of camouflage really blossomed into something almost unprecedented in its sophistication.
Well, camouflage really is an art, I think, and it began with artists. It began with artist Henderson Theater in the beginning of the century, and then the French artists who were working with the camouflage corps in World War I really perfected this based on cubist and geometric designs, as well as the natural camouflage of birds in the wild and so forth. So there's an incredible history there. And what these guys did was have to take it to an almost postmodern stage in which you had to camouflage something, but you had to do it just inexpertly enough that it looked like it had been camouflaged for real, but in fact you had made a mistake that was deliberate in order that the Germans would actually see what's in effect not a real tank camouflaged, but a fake tank, a rubber blow-up tank camouflaged to look like it had been camouflaged. So there was a real kind of double blind going on there. Nowadays I understand that we have camouflage uniforms that actually can make infrared light not as sensitive to them and can hide soldiers from night vision goggles and things. So it's come a long way, and it probably has some more ways to go.
It's an incredible book, and we learn about the participation of all kinds of rather nameless figures, but also the contribution of important people like actor Douglas Fairbanks Jr., all told thrillingly and fascinatingly in this book called Secret Soldiers. Philip Gerard, I'm so grateful that you wrote this book, and I'm sure that all of the men and women perhaps that participated in this work are so grateful, too, that this book has been written and this story finally told.
Well, one of my great pleasures in doing the book was being able to meet these guys and also to help some of them meet other pals that they hadn't seen since the war. And I think they were dying to tell their story, and I felt privileged to be the one to be able to tell it.
Secret Soldiers is published by Plume. Philip Gerard, we thank you for your time.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I'm going to be reconnecting with best-selling author J. Randy Tarabarelli. I have spoken with him on a number of occasions to talk about actually two different books about the Kennedy family, as well as one of the most interesting biographies of Elizabeth Taylor, one of all kinds of best-selling books he's written. His most recent book may be the most interesting of them all, called Grace and Steel: Dorothy, Barbara, Laura, and the Women of the Bush Dynasty. The book is a chronicle of the many significant and interesting women of the Bush family, including Barbara Bush, Laura Bush, and Dorothy Bush, who was the father of George H.W., the grandmother of George W. A very, very interesting book. We'll explore it tomorrow. On Friday's morning show, Larry Olmsted's book, Fans, which explores some of the intriguing benefits when we devote ourselves to the sports teams that we love. The value of sports fandom, explored on Friday's morning show. And this weekend on the podcast version of The Morning Show, You can hear a conversation I recorded many, many years ago with the Librarian of Congress when he came to Carthage to help dedicate the Hedberg Library. That will be Saturday's morning show, available as a podcast. The morning show podcast is available on all of the major podcast providers, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, Spotify. Make sure that you search for the podcast under the proper title, The Morning Show with Greg Berg.